And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're streaming live at kuci.org. Today's Wednesday, May 1st, 2019, May Day. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are Katiana Apkina and Amy Hempel. First up is Katia Apkina. Katia has had stories published in the Iowa Review, Santa Monica Review, West Branch, Joyland, Pank, and elsewhere, and has appeared on the notable list of Best American Non-Required Reading 2013. She translated poetry and prose for Night Wraps the Sky, writings by and about Mayakovsky, that FSG published in 2008, and it was shortlisted for the Best Translated Book Award. She was born in Moscow, currently lives in L.A., and Deeper the Water, the Uglier the Fish is her first novel and was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. Let's bring her on. Hi, Katia.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, of course. My pleasure. It's great to have you on. I so enjoyed your book, and I would love to hear you give an introduction to it, how it came about, and whatever you have to say about it. I'm all ears.
Sure. So the Deeper the Water, the Uglier the Fish came out of a nonfiction project, but very indirectly. When I'd been in my early 20s, I was hired to write to do research and write this nonfiction book about white Southerners who got involved in the civil rights movement in the 50s. And I did all this research. I was pretty, like, out of my depth. And then the book the editor left. The book never got published, but I had all this material that I was kind of trying to figure out what to do with. And it ended up being sort of the backstory for the characters in my book. And then also the form of the book, which is kind of unusual. The book is told from lots of different perspectives, kind of like an oral history, but not quite. And it does use, like, documents and journal entries and things like that. That also came out of the research I'd been doing, because when I was sitting in the archive, I was, like, reading a lot of oral histories and looking at documents, and I thought it was so interesting the way when you do that kind of research, your sense of, like, the truth of a situation kind of builds up and accumulates in these layers, and sometimes the layers, like, individually contradict each other, or not necessarily contradict each other, but, like, are kind of talking about the same thing but from two different angles or two different sides. And so I thought that was really interesting, like, what is the truth of a situation? Because obviously everybody's experience of it is different. So that also, that form also came out of that research I'd been doing. And then, I don't know what else to say about the novel. I guess I started it in 2012, and it took me what feels like forever to write. But I think it actually is not that unusual to take, I guess, like, 5 years. It came out in 2018, so, yeah, it came out about 6 years after I started it.
Hmm. So it's partially epistolary, and there's other things going on. There's psychiatric notes. There's some things going on that might have it be called an experimental novel. So talk about that. I mean, I don't know if you got any pushback on, you know, including things like the psychiatric notes on Marianne McLean, or, you know, or if, I mean, $2 Radio has been publishing some wonderful books. So I'm guessing that they, you know, they were all for what you were doing here.
Yeah, I mean, I think they were into how weird it was, and they were not scared of it, but I could see, it's unusual. I think the kind of more traditional way of doing this form would be to have it be some sort of oral history that, like, a person in the story is compiling for some sort of reason, and to have that be kind of revealed, like, three-quarters of the way through. And I just did not want to do that. I don't know. I guess it's all very kind of instinctual, but that form felt very familiar to me, and I just wasn't interested in it. So that's sort of the reason why it's almost an oral history, but not quite, because one of the accounts, one of the sisters, Edith, is told in the present tense of the story, and the other characters are all looking back at the story. So I tried to sort of break the form, to break that expectation in the reader that this would be like a conventionally told novel. I don't know. I mean, I wasn't like setting out specifically to be experimental, but I guess there's always just something in me that likes to be difficult. I don't know. Not that the book is difficult, but I think like doing it the easy way, like, I don't know why I can never seem to do anything the easy way. It's always like the most complicated, indirect way. I mean, I think originally I thought that telling the story from lots of different points of view would be the easy way, rather than maintaining, you know, just one voice through the novel. Because I'd been coming from a background of short stories, so there is something kind of intimidating about just like writing something long. And I thought, oh, this will be a neat trick. Like, this will make it super simple. And I would not say it made it simple. But I don't know. I mean, I think to some extent, you just kind of write the way that you're, the way that kind of, as you're writing the novel, is sort of guiding you. And it's your job as the writer to just listen to what it's telling you to do. And I tried to do that. So, you know, most of the choices that a writer makes are probably like these subconscious choices, not really like conscious ones. But at the same time, like that said, I did outline the book a lot as I was working on it. So I was trying to kind of keep it in a structure, and I did want it to be, like, I think when people say experimental, people immediately assume that it's something that's like impenetrable or not very readable. And I didn't want it to be that. Like, I wanted it to be a quick read, sort of, or at least just like engrossing, while also being like kind of breaking with form or breaking with expectations and sort of pushing back at the reader a little bit.
Yeah. No, I didn't find it troubling at all. I mean, I mean, the chapters, for instance, some are as short as a page, and, you know, that keeps a reader turning the page no matter what. You know, I like the various points of view. They all seem to kind of one followed, you know, in order somehow. So I can see how an outline would have helped to keep you on track or, you know, have it work, because I, you know, nothing really felt out of place. You know, you know, the interview, there's an interview with Dennis, one of the main characters, and that came at the right place, chapter 4, I think it is. So, I don't know. I didn't find it difficult.
Good.
But, you know, I am curious about what you just said. You just said that you outlined the book as you were working on it, and I wonder if you would talk about that.
Sure. Well, the outline would evolve. I think I'm just a very disorganized person. So what for some people would just kind of remain in their head and wouldn't need to be kind of like external, you know, like put onto a piece of paper. For me, it was very helpful to have these sort of reminders to myself of what direction I'm going in. So it wasn't like a very specific outline, but it was more sort of like, where am I headed for each section, or like what needs to happen in each section, in each chapter. So it evolved a lot. I think like when I started it, the ending was actually like closer to the beginning. And then as it sort of, as I started writing it and everything inside of it sort of started expanding, I realized that the ending I was writing towards, like I kind of knew where I was going with all of it, and I was just heading there.
Did you know where you were going from the start? I mean, before you even started writing, did you have a general idea of what you wanted the book to be?
I think I knew pretty early. I mean, I don't know that I could have articulated what I wanted the book to be. I think it's actually really helped me hear from readers and critics like what the book is. And then I'm like, oh, yeah, that is what the book is. And I think, like, intuitively, that's what I wanted the book to be, but I don't know that I could have told you very clearly at the beginning what I was trying to do, necessarily. But I knew pretty early on, like, what the book was moving towards. Like, about a year into working on the book, I had to just start over from the very beginning, which was hard because I felt like I'd already invested a year. And I think in my mind, I was like, a novel takes, like, a year to write, right? So after, like, working on it for a year, maybe it was honestly even longer, like a year and a half, in the story, like, the way I had started it, the mother was dead at the beginning. And so then it just, I kept writing it, but it just kept being this novel about grief, and it was such a strong emotion that just overtook anything else that the book also wanted to be about. It became kind of difficult, and I didn't really want to write that novel. Like, it didn't feel like the novel that I wanted to write, so I had to start over and bring the mother back to life. So I guess that was sort of from, and then once that sort of fell into place, the book, like, knowing kind of the events of what happened in the book were pretty clear to me, and it just, you know, I just had to write them all.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Katya Apakina. Her book is The Deeper the Water, The Uglier the Fish, published by $2 Radio. The father character, Dennis, was really interesting to me. He reminded me a little bit of Truman Capote, actually, in how Capote was said to use people, to use his friends, and ended up at the end of his life alienating his friends, actually. And I found some similarities between Dennis and the father. I mean, Dennis and Capote, because Dennis is very charismatic and is just really captivating in so many ways. And I wonder if you would talk about Dennis and how that character came about.
Yeah, so Dennis in the novel, he's a famous writer, and he uses, you know, his own life for material. His books are, like, pretty autobiographical, even though they might have, like, fantastical elements. And specifically, his wife, who he marries when she's very young and who he's known since she was a child, is his muse and sort of the inspiration for a lot of his books and sort of the central obsession in his work. I don't know. I mean, he was not based on one specific writer, but I think there's so many writers that are these kind of vampires for the people around them, or an artist in general. You know, I mean, I think, like, there's this kind of the male genius artist has, like, a place in our culture, and they're sort of, they use everyone they can. And it's sort of justified because their art is so brilliant or whatever. It has been justified. But we never really hear from the people around them who whose, like, blood and marrow is being used for the art. And so in the book, even though there's some journal entries from him and some interviews with him, and you sort of get a sense of his perspective, he's not really given a voice. There are not sections from him in the way there are from the other characters, because I think he's, first of all, that's, like, a story that we hear very often. We usually hear the story from that type of person's perspective. And also, just because he's so charismatic, it would just kind of overwhelm the other characters and sort of push the reader to be more sympathetic with him than I want them to be, I guess, you know, just because we're so, I think, like, if it's ingrained in you to be sympathetic to that point of view, it just becomes sort of like a reflex to do that, whether you really believe that or not. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to push against that by not including too much of him. But there is some of him included so that you have kind of, so that you at least, like, get a sense of where he's coming from.
Yeah. And the main characters, Edie and May, I'm curious about a couple of things. Why sisters? Why did you feel that you really needed two? And, you know, what brought you to that decision? And is it more one story than the other? I mean, do you see one main protagonist here? Is it really Edie's story? And even though we have, you know, a lot of point of view characters.
Yeah, so Edie and May were kind of the beginning of the book. Like, they were the thing that started their relationship, was the thing that started the whole novel. I think it was, I have a brother, but we are like 14 years apart. So it's kind of more exaggerated in our case, but I think it's really interesting the way people grow up in one family and have completely different experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was something I wanted to explore. And I always wanted a sister. I always wanted a twin sister. But yeah, I think
it's
like that relationship, that kind of closeness, and at mm-hmm. the same time, that sort of competition for parental attention and love, and like the different role you have to play, and the feelings of resentment that you might have if you're the one in the role of like the caretaker, especially when you're parents are not taking care of you. And also, you know, both the parents in the story are not very parental, or just not giving the daughters, you know, the basic things that they need, the attention and love, because they, you know, they not because they're evil necessarily, just because they can't. And so it's sort of the two different ways of responding to that was interesting to me. And the way that both daughters want something from each parent that they're not getting, and they sort of align with the different parents, was also interesting to me. And like the way that in a family, even in like a healthy family, the boundaries between parents and children can feel very blurry. Like if you're a parent, you know, you feel very close to your child, and then your child becomes like a separate person, an independent person. And I think that sort of shift from being like these two very close kind of interdependent people to two separate people feels very kind of like universal and traumatic at the same time for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think that was, all of those things were, like, interesting to me when I was thinking about doing it with two kids in the family.
Hmm. Well, you know, I read, I don't know where I read this, I found an interview that you did with someone, and you said something that I wrote down that I wondered if you would talk about. And you said, to me, the creation of art, specifically writing, feels like it both requires a lot of empathy, but also a lot of selfishness. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, you have endless amounts of empathy for characters that you've made up, and that sometimes can maybe like use up the empathy that you have for real people in your life. I mean, I don't know. I'm also like a mother, and so writing and being kind of in my head, and then also having to balance that with then being like present and there for my family. Like it's a very, those are two such different states of being, and to go back and forth between them is like sometimes a little dizzying. But I do think like in general, being able to, you know, I think in general, writing is about imagining the point of view of others, right? So I do think it's like an exercise in empathy, kind of ultimately being able to kind of imagine why people do the things that they do. You know, not necessarily like justifying, not saying like that it's good or bad that they do the things that they do, but just even being able to place yourself in their position and just imagine what life is like for somebody else. Is like a valuable thing to do, I think.
Well, along those lines, I'm curious if you're able to turn off the work, turn off the characters, turn off the story when you're attending to your family and your, you know, your other life. Your, I don't know, I don't want to say your real life, but...
yeah, know. Well, it is funny because it is my real life, but sometimes it doesn't feel necessarily like more real than my fantasy life. It can be hard, yeah. I have a partner, a husband who's like a very good parent and very involved. And so I feel like when, and he's also in a creative profession, so I feel like we can take turns kind of disappearing into our minds.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's important. And also I've done, you know, art residencies where I just disappear for like 2 weeks. Well, it used to be like a month, but since my daughter's been born, it's just 2 weeks at a time, and can really, you know, completely focus. And those have been valuable to be able to just, you know, they feed you. You don't have to think about like anything practical, and you can just completely focus on finishing something, which is very valuable.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, even when you structure your life the way you want to structure your life, you still have, you know, all the daily stuff. And it's amazing how when you get away, you're able to just focus in a way that even when you devote a day at home to your work, it doesn't happen the same way.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's just also something about being in a new space, removed from just familiar things, that can be helpful also.
And we have a few minutes left. Fortunately, you're going to be down here in Orange County on May 14th at the Pen on Fire Salon. And if anyone out there wants to know more, go to my website, penonfire.com. And I think there's still seats left. But so there's so much more to talk to you about. But I wanted, in the minute or two we have left, I wonder if there's any advice or, I don't know, anything any of your mentors or instructors or anybody you've worked with said to you or taught you that has stayed with you throughout?
Well, so I did an MFA, and I had started writing also like as an undergrad in college. I took a few writing classes. So for me, like that sort of the support of a class was really helpful. I didn't start writing the novel until after I was done with my MFA, but just having other people who can read your work is really important. And when I say read your work, I mean not even necessarily give you feedback, but just read it. Because I think a lot of times when you're working on a long project like a novel, it can feel very disheartening at times, or you just feel very adrift, and you want to get somebody else. I found it very helpful having other people just look at it, and I didn't necessarily want feedback too early. Like, I did want feedback eventually, but when something is sort of in the, when you're still figuring something out, getting feedback can be a little bit, I think a little bit bad for the process, or it can just, it's all very delicate, and it can kind of knock you out of it a little bit. But having someone just read it and say, keep going, I think is like the most valuable thing you can have when you're working on a long project and feeling like, will I ever get to the end of this?
Mm-hmm. Right. And maybe it helps us be accountable a little bit too, if there's someone sort of at the other end.
Yeah, and resist asking for any sort of advice too, because I think ultimately nobody can give you advice. You have to figure out what your book is yourself. I mean, people can tell you about their experience reading it and like how they felt, but I don't think they can tell you what you need to do.
Yeah.
And I think it's very tempting to want somebody to tell you what you need to do, because you know, because it's hard, and you want someone to just be like, just do this, and then everything will work. But
right.
I don't think anyone can actually tell you to do that. That has to come from you.
Mm. Katya, thank you so much for taking the time, and I can't wait for May 14th. It'll be great to talk more.
Yeah, I can't wait. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. That was Katya Apkina. Her book is The Deeper the Water, The Uglier the Fish, published by $2 Radio. Stay with us. Amy Hempel will be up next.
Oh, yes. such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just a thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Oh, honey, just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby, I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Oh, I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. Such a long, long time. Looks like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just a thought of you,
just a
thought, my love, my whole world turns misty blue.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org. We're on iTunes. Look for the podcast Writers on Writing, which you may want to do if you're just tuning in so that you can catch the beginning of the show with Katya Apakina and hundreds upon hundreds of shows on iTunes that you can catch, and you can subscribe when you're there. And when we upload a show, which is typically a few days after it airs, it will land in your podcast file on your computer or on your phone or wherever it is that you listen to podcasts. In any case, I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I am here now with Amy Hempel. Amy Hempel's four short story collections, The Dog of the Marriage, Tumble Home, At the Gates of the Animal Kingdom, and Reasons to Live, are now in a single volume, The Collected Stories of Amy Hempel. She was actually on the show when that book came out, whenever that was. Feels like it's been years. Sorry, I do have a frog in my throat. Her stories have appeared in Harper's, O, the Oprah Magazine, Vanity Fair, GQ, and Tin House, and have been widely anthologized. She's received a Guggenheim Fellowship, an award in literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and the Pan Malamud Award. She teaches in the graduate writing program at Bennington College and at Stony Brook, Southampton. She lives near New York City, and her most recent collection is Sing to It, New Stories by Amy Hempel. Hi there.
Hi.
Great to have you on. You know, it's funny.
Thank you.
I've known of your work and have been reading your stories, I don't know, since the late 70s maybe, but I just recently read an interview you did with the Paris Review, I think came out in 2003, and one of the first things the writer said was that you didn't enjoy interviews, and so I hope this is okay for you.
This is fine. I've gotten over that.
Okay.
Yes.
but there's so much to talk about, and one thing that always strikes me about your work is your writing has the abbreviated confidence of poetry. And I know you have a journalism background. I don't know what your background is in poetry. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
I have no formal background in studying poetry in school and college. I just read it and have read it for years. It's been hugely important to me as a writer and has been and continues to be. More contemporary poetry, actually, and I do a great deal of rereading. I try in some of the short stories I write to kind of blur the line between short story and prose poem. I find that I profit greatly from paying attention to a poet's concerns writing poetry, though I cannot quite write poetry. I don't have a real understanding of the line, whereas I do understand the sentence. But reading it is so important. And when I'm writing, I can still read poetry, but when I'm writing, I cannot or don't want to take in much other fiction, you know, the anxiety of influence and all of that. But poetry is always welcome and important to me.
Well, some of your stories really do seem like prose poems to me.
Thank you.
So that's interesting. But you've been writing, I think, flash fiction before it was even called flash. I think.
Yes.
I remember it being called sudden fiction at one point, and then
there have been many names for it, but it's somebody, I think Irving Howe many years ago, had the best description of it I've heard. He said it's like a short story, only more so.
Yeah. That's great. Well, you know, I went back to your collection as well as having read Sing to It. And I noticed that, I mean, you can do a story in a line and as well as, you know, paragraph, as well as long stories. And so in this collection, in Sing to It, the book ends with Cloudland that may even be a novella. Is it a novella?
I think of it as a novella. It was originally twice as long, and I agreed entirely with my editor, Nan Graham, that there were things that really didn't need to be included. And then I went even beyond that in cutting it back, and I think it's where it needs to be. But it did certainly begin as a novella. I think it still has the scale and scope of a novella, though it is, you know, short. It's more than a long story. You know what I mean? It takes on, I think, more than a long story. So, yes, I do think of it still as a novella.
And, you know, when I read the acknowledgments after I read the stories, and apparently this was somewhat based on the Butterbox Babies. Is that so?
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
That was a horrible, horrible time in Nova Scotia decades ago. A fraud, a very terrible fraud was perpetrated against many unknowing people, such that there was a place called the Ideal Maternity Home, which is quite ironic. The Ideal Maternity Home, where girls would go, give birth, be assured the babies would be adopted by good families, and many of these babies were left to die. So it really was about the mass murders over years and years of babies. It was a horrifying story. I learned about it, I think the notes are acknowledgments to my book. I heard about this by reading Betty Cahill's book. She's a Canadian journalist about this, the series of crimes. But I learned about that book from Chuck Palahniuk, a brilliant, generous writer, friend, who had researched it, thinking it might be something he would incorporate into a novel he would write. But if you know Chuck's work, you know that his work is always really darkly funny, as well as, you know, whatever else he's doing. And as he said, there's nothing funny about this history. And he told me about it years ago and said, you know, I'm not going to use it, but I thought you might be interested, and gave me the story, you know, gave it to me. Not the story I wrote, but he told me about the real story. And so I didn't do anything with it for, I don't know, maybe 3 years. And then I tried to imagine my way into a kind of modern day situation like that. But that was very much the start of what I did.
I'm curious if you do that often. I mean, do you let sort of real life incidents, stories, things you see in the paper generate stories? I mean, does that happen for you a lot?
Not things I see in the paper, not current events, not outside news, but it has happened from time to time with personal history, you know, family history. There is a story in the new book that I think I mentioned in the notes or acknowledgments, took me 30 years to write, a story called The Chicane. And it does have as its point of departure something that happened in my family, my young aunt's suicide in Portugal, in Lisbon, and 30 years. And, you know, why did it take 30 years? It just did. And I think because of the factual basis, though a good deal has changed in the story that resulted, I really had even more need to get it just the way I hoped it would work, and that just took a really long time. But what's the hurry? You know?
Well, you know, I want to return to something Rick Moody said in the intro about you and your work in the last collection. And he said that The Dog of Marriage in that collection took you 8 years. And it's, I think the story is maybe 3 pages, something like that. It's pretty short. And so I was curious, and what you just said just now about Chicane, just what about that? What about letting stories sit? I mean, do you just reach a point and you go, you know what, it's not finished, but I just need to let it rest? I mean, how does that go for you, that you will put something away and return to it? And will you return to it, you know, every year, every other year, every month? I don't know.
I don't do it often. In fact, I did cite the one about my aunt taking, you know, 30 years. Ordinarily, no. Ordinarily, I just tough it out and keep going, figuring, you know, you can only do what you can do. So I can't pass a point. I know I've done what I can. I mean, at a point, I know I've done what I can. And it works or it doesn't work. But I like to stay with it. I think there's something that happens if you just stay with a piece of work longer than you might want to, that there can be at times a kind of surrender to it, after which something can occur to you. So I don't tend to put things aside. I also don't like that they start to haunt you. You know, they start to haunt you. And not in an unpleasant way. There are pleasant ways to be haunted, but that's not one of them.
So will you write a story in one sitting if you can?
Nothing happens that quickly. I think that happened to me once in my second collection. I think, that's happened to me exactly once in so many years of writing that I just sat down and, you know, at one go, wrote it. It was a short, and wish it would happen again.
Mm. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Amy Hempel. Her new collection is Sing to It. The most heartrending story in this collection, you probably know what it is. I cannot forget a full-service shelter. And I know you've been involved with dogs and shelters for years, and you've written about dogs throughout all of your work. Was this a difficult one to write, or at this point, are you able to be desensitized enough about what goes on in shelters to write about it?
Yeah, I'll never be desensitized to what goes on in the worst kinds of animal shelters. That story was not hard to write so much as it was hard to live, because I did work in a hike-kill shelter, volunteer work for a couple of years, and this was a few years ago, and you know, it was as horrifying as you might think. Or I wrote it. I didn't intend to write about that experience. It was something I was very passionately concerned about, what happens to animals who are not who do not find homes and who are in kill shelters. And it was so much worse than I thought it would be. And I remember thinking when I started, how can I do this? How will I stand it? And a wise friend said, this may be a Buddhist kind of concern or attitude. She said, doing it makes you able to do it. And I thought, okay, let's just try that. And I worked with a small group, about 9 other volunteers, and we focused on dogs that were on each day's youth list. And that is not youth like young people; it's youth, short for euthanasia. And we just tried to get them out of there. We did e-blasts. Bios on the dogs, each dog photos. And I said before that this was the most important writing I've done in my life. Writing biographies, little appealing biographies of these dogs who were virtually doomed, in the hopes that somebody would see it online and think, I've got to go meet that dog this minute. I've got to go get that dog. And, we got some dogs out. And a lot of dogs, we're not that lucky.
I just every day I wake up and I think about that story, and it also makes me think of your work in journalism and that story and the one we just spoke of, Cloudland, based on sort of life. And I wonder just about that, about the crossover from journalism to fiction, if there is any other kind of crossover that you can see.
Well, one crossover is that you have to, whatever form you're working in, you have to make it riveting, and you have to not give a reader any chance to stop reading. In journalism, they used to say, they used to talk about the grabber. What's the line that's going to hook the reader and keep the reader reading? And that holds for fiction as well. And just don't let a reader turn away. That certainly holds. Obviously, you have more freedom in fiction than in journalism. And ultimately, writing fiction is, for me, more satisfying because there's an old interview with Joan Didion in the Paris Review series, where she talks about why writing fiction for her was more satisfying than journalism and nonfiction. And that's because she said in nonfiction and journalism, the discovery comes in the research and the reporting, and then you write it up. But in fiction, the discovery comes while you're actually writing.
I agree.
That's been my experience as well.
Well, speaking of grabbers, yeah, your stories just get, you know, grab you and keep you reading right from the start. And so I'm curious how, if that hook, if that grabber comes right away for you, or if that's something in the revision process that you are refining and carving away at.
It never turns up in revision. I always have the first line and the last line. This has been the case my whole writing life. I've had to have the first and last line of a story or novella at the start. I know nothing in between, so there's no, you know, outline. God knows, I hate the idea of outlining fiction. There's no template. There's just the first line and the last line, and both don't change. They never have.
Interesting. I wonder if we can talk about, we have a few minutes left, and I wonder if we can talk about one story in the collection that perhaps gave you a hard time, or that you really had to kind of work at trying to figure out what it was about, or even just deconstructing a story, even one of the short shorts, if you want, in terms of, you know, how it started and how then you got, you finished up.
Well, there's a story, maybe this fits your, what you're talking about. There's a story, it appeared first in my second collection, and it's called The Harvest, and it does combine both fiction and a kind of journalism. I wrote a story, a very short story, that grew out of an actual motorcycle accident I'd been in as a teenager. And I thought it was finished, and I was pretty pleased with it. And then a few days later, less than a week later, I thought, wait a minute, that's not done. And I was thinking about what I changed from the way it really happened to make it work as a piece of fiction. And I just wrote it, I started writing that down. So the story is published as the two parts with the space break in between, the fictive parts and then the supposedly real, real way it happened, the accident and aftermath happened. The discovery, what was so interesting to me doing that, and by the way, then I knew it was finished, then it was complete. But what I discovered was that the myth-making impulse is so firmly in place when you're writing from experience, from real experience, that you can't help yourself from embellishing or, you know, changing things to make it stronger, whatever. And so I learned that the real version wasn't completely real either, and then I could go on in a kind of infinite way trying to get at a certain truth. And I thought that was kind of fascinating to find that. I didn't know that that would be the case.
Well, you know, it kind of connects with my next question, which is, do you find that you edit your work even after it's been published, or at what point does revision end? When are you able to just leave it alone?
I don't change things, stories after they've been published. I know people who do, and I think that's fascinating. And I do, I've always trusted it and liked it when I've been at a reading, the author's reading from a finished book and still has a pen in hand making changes. I respect that very deeply. I don't do it. You know, it's done, it's done. And that's fine. I don't have an impulse to change after. By the time I submit something, that's it.
So how do you know when a story is done? I mean, do you just know at this point that it's done? You just can't do anything else, or maybe you're futzing with commas and punctuation, or what tells you that it's just time?
I rely on a visceral reaction. Emily Dickinson, I think, had the description of feeling as the top of your head, you know, lifted off, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'll get a physical sensation. It's not like that, but maybe I honestly can't even really describe it, and it's one of those nice mysteries about
mm-hmm.
writing.
Sure.
But I don't. It's not. In other words, it's not an intellectual matter. It's not a rationalized decision. It's just I recognize it physically in a certain way.
Hmm. I am so sad that we're at the end of our time. I wonder
already.
I know.
Oh my!
It went too fast. I wonder if, well, two things. One, if there are any poets you recommend to our listeners, and two, if there's any last words or pearls of wisdom you'd like to pass on to the short story writers who are listening.
Well, a poet I think everyone should read or read more of, he's out in Michigan, is John Rubicki, and I'm going to spell that last name or you people won't be able to find him. R-Y-B, like boy, I-C-K-I. He has three books of poems out there, and I read him and reread him a great deal. He's quite something. And I don't know about a bit of wisdom, but I think I'd do better to just recommend a first great poet, John Rubicki, and there.
Well, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you again,
you too.
Love your book, and look forward to the next collection.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks for having me.
Oh, you're so welcome. That was Amy Hempel. Her book is Sing to It, New Stories, and lovely cover. So much that we didn't get to, but at least we got to what we got to, right? You've been listening to Writers on Writing. Tune in next week. We'll have more for you.